Good morning, brothers and sisters. Last week in our series on 2 Corinthians, we looked at the final part of chapter 11, where Paul joined the false teachers in a boasting match. His desperate last-ditch plan to reach the Corinthians was to fight the false teachers on their own terms. They were boasting by the world standards about how great they were, so Paul would also boast. It was the only thing left that might convince the Corinthians not to abandon the gospel. Except, as we saw, he didn't really do that. Although he started off boasting about his Jewish ancestry, as the false teachers would, he immediately turned the boasting match on its head and instead began boasting about his weaknesses. He recounted all the sufferings he had endured, putting all of his lowest and most humiliating moments on full display. And remember that although this list of sufferings is really impressive to us today, in the culture of the ancient world, it was the opposite. Suffering was shameful, and they would have been horrified to see Paul boasting about what he had suffered. That was the point. He wasn't going to match the false teachers at all. Instead of boasting about how strong he boasted about how weak he was. And he did that in preparation for our passage today. In this passage, Paul is going to talk about his greatest weakness of all, the thorn in the flesh, and he's going to explain why he has been boasting about his weaknesses. And it's because God's power is made perfect in weakness. This passage is teaching the Corinthians and us that the Christian life is not about self-sufficiency and strength. Rather, it is about dependency and brokenness. It is about acknowledging our weaknesses, bringing them to God, and letting Him be strong in our weakness. Last week, Paul was practicing that himself by boasting about all of his weaknesses. In this passage today, he invites us to do the same. So let's get into the text. 2 Corinthians chapter 12, verses 1 through 10. The first point today is straightforward. We should be humble about our strengths. 2 Corinthians 12:1. I must go on boasting. Although there is nothing to be gained, I will go on to visions and revelations from the Lord. Paul is not done with the little boasting match that he's having with the false teachers. He's already tricked them once by starting up boasting about the Jewish ancestry and then suddenly turning that on his head and boasting about suffering. Now he's going to do the same thing again. It appears he's back on track to boast about the same worldly things that they boasted about. One of their most important claims was having received visions and revelations. In most cases, I imagine they were completely making it up, but it was an impressive story. If they claimed God had directly spoken to them and shown them wondrous visions, who could challenge their claim to be apostles? So Paul is now going to join them and boast about his own visions. From the book of Acts alone, we know he had a lot to boast about. Jesus appeared directly to Paul on the road to Damascus. Paul had a vision of a Macedonian man calling him to preach the gospel in that region. He also had Jesus appear directly to him and offer him encouragement while he was in Corinth, the very church that he's now writing to. That's in Acts 18, 9 through 10. There are other visions recorded in Acts, but they come later than this letter was written. So Paul already has the false teachers completely beat when it comes to revelations, because he wasn't making this stuff up. Jesus Christ had actually appeared to him. Paul had a lot to boast about, but this is where Paul pulls, again, a bait and switch on the false teachers and does the opposite of what they would expect. Verse 2, I know a man in Christ who 14 years ago was caught up to the third heaven. Whether it was in the body or out of the body, I do not know. God knows. And I know that this man, whether in the body or apart from the body, I do not know, but God knows, was caught up to paradise and heard inexpressible things, things that no one is permitted to tell. Paul recounts a crazy vision that a certain someone received. And spoiler alert, a certain someone is Paul himself. It's clear from the context that Paul was the one who received this vision. He says in verse 7 that because of these surpassingly great revelations, he was given the thorn in the flesh, which means that these revelations were indeed his. And the vision he recounts is quite crazy. It took place 14 years ago, which would be several years after Paul's conversion, and he was caught up to the third heaven, which means capital H, heaven, the throne room of God. In verse 4, he calls it paradise. This is the real deal. There were all sorts of cosmologies in the ancient world that described 3, 5, or 7 heavens. And Paul's using that sort of language to indicate that he was brought into the very presence of God the Father. The significance of this vision is hard to overstate. From around this time, there was a story of 4 rabbis who were temporarily taken up into paradise, and their experience was so devastatingly powerful that only one returned unharmed. Going to paradise was the vision of visions. It was the greatest revelation you could receive. And Paul has received that vision. He doesn't know if it was in the body or out of the body, but it happened. He went into God's presence and heard inexpressible things, things too wonderful for words, things that no one is allowed to know. Whatever visions the false teachers were fabricating, this would blow those out of the water. Paul absolutely has them beat on the matter of visions, except he doesn't even try to beat them. When he recounts this story, he tells it in the third person, distancing himself from the event. He pretends he didn't have this vision. He says, "I know a man in Christ who was caught up to the third heaven." And in verse 5, he says, "I will boast about a man like that, but I will not boast about myself except about my weaknesses." In the boasting competition, he was sitting there with the trump card, and he threw it in the garbage. The fact that we don't hear about this vision anywhere else shows the truth of Paul's humility. He had an experience like this, and he never brought it up. That can actually be a little frustrating for us. How can he casually bring this up and then not elaborate? We want to know more. But that's the point. Paul didn't really care. He wasn't really interested in the great things he'd seen or the miraculous things he'd done. He didn't concern himself with thinking about his strengths or accomplishments. He could have a story like this, which would blow anyone's mind, which would destroy the false teachers in a flash, and he casually tosses it aside. He speaks of it only now at the very end of this extended section. He recounts it extremely briefly. He recounts it in the third person, and then quickly redirects our attention to his thorn in the flesh, the ultimate sign of his weakness. And that's the first point. We should be humble about our strengths. Paul had possibly the greatest strengths of all, and he never brought them up. He knew they were there, but he didn't give them much thought. He didn't put much stock in them. He knew they were from God, and so all that mattered was using them to serve God. He goes on to say, "Even if I should choose to boast, I would not be a fool, because I would be speaking the truth. But I refrain, so that no one will think more of me than is warranted by what I do or say, or because of these surpassingly great revelations." He wouldn't be foolish to boast, because unlike the false teachers, he wouldn't be making anything up. But he only boasts about his weaknesses. He was completely humble about his strengths. Really, the best word, he was indifferent about them. That's what makes this brief account frustrating for us. We want to know more, but Paul is indifferent. He doesn't really care about his great visions. And he said that he doesn't want anyone to think more of him than is warranted by what he does or says. He wants their opinions solely to be based on his actions. He won't try to bolster anyone's opinion of him by bragging or showing off his strengths. He'll just serve God and let them think what they think. He was letting these false teachers get away with so much, dragging his name through the mud, making him look bad, propping themselves up at his expense. He could have torn their arguments to shreds by recounting even just a fraction of the things that he had to boast about. Instead, he did the opposite. He helped them. In the last chapter, he listed all his most humiliating and shameful moments. He helped them make himself look bad. They were ganging up on him, beating him on the ground, and he decided, "Looks like you guys could use an extra pair of fists." And we'll talk more about that in a minute. Why would he want to make himself look bad in connection with the thorn in the flesh? But for this first point, we see his humility about his strengths. We are called to live with that same humility. There's nothing wrong with taking pride in hard work or in well-earned skills. But Paul is presenting a radically different way of life, a life where we don't really care about our strengths. We know they're there, but we don't think much of them. They're not all that important to us. I would suggest the only reason Paul could do this was because his identity was secure. He was a child of God, and so he had nothing to prove. Not to other people, and significantly, not to himself either. His self-worth didn't depend on believing in his strengths. He didn't need to keep his accomplishments right before him as a reminder that he was a valuable person. His value came from God. And so all these strengths, they didn't do much for him. They were there, but he would be fine if they weren't. If he had never received a single vision, if he'd never succeeded in making a single convert, if all of his life accomplishments were stripped away, he was still a child of God. He didn't need those strengths to convince himself that he mattered, and so he was almost indifferent about them. We can take pride in our work, but we have to remember that that work does not give us our value. We are children of God whether we accomplish great things or not, whether we are talented or not, whether we are successful or not. If we understand that, then our strengths shouldn't really mean all that much to us. They're nice to have, but they don't affect who we are. We don't need them to be there. We could lose everything and still be just as valuable in God's eyes. And that attitude can be reflected in how we live. What if we were the sort of people who had all sorts of accomplishments and skills, but generally kept them under wraps? God knows they're there, we know they're there, and that's enough. What if you did some great act of service for God and didn't tell anyone? It takes a lot of humility to be able to do that. Paul really embodied that. He was very quiet about his strengths. Some food for thought. What if, like Paul, you told a story about your greatest accomplishment, but you made it sound like it was someone else? This passage isn't saying you have to do that, but just as a thought experiment, would you be willing to do that? Or is maybe there some pride there that wants to be fed? Do you put a lot of stock in your strengths and accomplishments? Are you depending on them to show that you have value? We can think about some situations along the same lines. Would you be willing to let someone else take credit for your work? Would you be willing to let your efforts go unnoticed? Again, I'm not saying you should do that, but if there is a violent repulsion to that idea, that's a sign that maybe you're getting your value from the wrong place. Maybe you're letting your accomplishments define who you are. Ultimately, we are children of God. We have nothing to prove to anyone, including ourselves. This passage isn't so much saying that we shouldn't care about our strengths, but that we don't need to. Our value comes from Jesus, not from anything that we do. If all of our accomplishments were taken away, it would not change anything about us. That is what allows us to be humble about our strengths. Because of that, we shouldn't boast about them to others, and we shouldn't put that much stock in them ourselves. The only thing that matters for us is our identity as children of God, and that identity will never change. So the first point, we should be humble about our strengths. The second point, we should boast about our weaknesses. We briefly saw Paul mention this in verse 5. I will not boast about myself except about my weakness. But we especially saw this last week in chapter 11. That was the entire point of the previous passage. He spent paragraph after paragraph recounting his sufferings, boasting about every time he had been weak, every shameful or humiliating experience, every time he failed. And again, he said in chapter 11, verse 30, if I must boast, I will boast of the things that show my weakness. This has been a huge idea of boasting in weakness, but up to this point, Paul hasn't really explained why. Again and again, he's boasted proudly about how weak he is. Now, at the end of it, he explains why he has been doing this. These last verses are the culmination of this entire section, and they bring to a close one of the most important themes in the book. Picking up with the second half of verse 7. Therefore, in order to keep me from becoming conceited, I was given a thorn in my flesh, a messenger of Satan to torment me. Paul brings up his greatest weakness of all, his thorn in the flesh. He leaves the specifics quite vague. The term he uses, thorn in the flesh, makes it clear that it's something that hinders, that frustrates or causes trouble, that is painful. And there's lots of possibilities about what that could have entailed. Some have suggested it refers to spiritual harassment from the enemy, like temptations. Others have suggested it refers to persecution, or to the Corinthian church's rejection of him. However, the most common suggestion is that it was a physical ailment of some sort. You've probably heard the theory that it may have been eye trouble. That's one option. Other theories include malarial fever, stammering speech, epilepsy, headaches, or neurological disturbances. Ultimately, there isn't enough information to know exactly what Paul was talking about. But regardless of what it was specifically, we know that this was a hindrance to Paul's ministry and a great burden that weighed heavily upon him. He calls it a messenger from Satan to torment him. That's very strong language. This troubled Paul deeply. It caused him mental and physical anguish. It often overwhelmed him. Last week we saw the list of all the things that Paul had been through and survived. So if he considers this the worst of his afflictions, it must have been very serious indeed. And the fact that it's from Satan is also significant. We know from the book of Job that Satan can only do these sorts of things if God allows him. He couldn't lay a finger on Job until God gave him permission. How much do you think Satan wanted to torment Paul? Paul was the most effective servant for the kingdom of God. I think it's fair to say that. He planted so many churches, made so many converts, and is single-handedly responsible for so much of the spread of the gospel. I can guarantee you, Satan hated that. He hated Paul, and he wanted nothing more than to hinder Paul, to put stumbling blocks and obstacles in his path. And God allowed him to do that. He evidently gave Satan permission to give Paul the thorn in the flesh to torment him. Something so agonizing that Paul pleaded with God 3 times to take it away. This is very significant. God took his most effective servant and basically crippled him. Why would he do that? Why would he ever let Satan hinder Paul's work? Imagine how much further the gospel could have gotten. How many more churches could have been planted? How many more people baptized if Paul had been able to work without opposition and without the thorn in the flesh? All those sufferings he listed in the last chapter. God was omnipotent. He could have prevented all that, but he chose not to. He let Paul suffer and struggle and be hindered at every turn. Again and again, he crippled his most effective servant. Why would he ever do that? Take a look at verses 8 and 9. 3 times I pleaded with the Lord to take it away from me, but he said to me, "My grace is sufficient for you, for my power is made perfect in weakness." God's power is made perfect in weakness. God was not most powerful in Paul's moments of strength. He was most powerful in Paul's moments of weakness. See, when Paul was confident and strong and thinking that he had everything under control, there's no room for God to work. God says, "I can't really use that." But when Paul is broken before God, at the end of his rope, saying, "I can't do this, I don't have the strength," then God says, "Perfect, I do. Let me be strong for you. Rely on me." That is when God has room to work. But why is that the case? What does it mean for God's power to be made perfect in weakness? It's all about self-sufficiency versus dependence. Look back at verse 7. He says, "All this happened in order to keep me from becoming conceited." In other words, to keep him from relying on himself. We as humans have nothing. Apart from God, we can do nothing. We cannot save souls. We cannot transform hearts. We cannot even change ourselves. We are entirely dependent on God. But it's very hard to live like that and to remember that. It's so easy to be self-sufficient, to go about our days entirely relying on our own abilities. Usually, it's only when we are confronted with our weakness that we choose to rely on God. I want you to think of the story of Gideon fighting the Midianites. Gideon had a huge army to fight against them, but what did God do? He made Gideon send everyone home except 300 soldiers. What was he doing? He was forcing them to realize that they needed him. If they had a big army, they would rely on themselves, and so they would lose. If they had only 300 men, victory was impossible on their own. They had to look to God. God forced them to throw their self-sufficiency out the window, because it was only then that they would win. A large army and strength meant they would lose, but a small army and weakness meant they would win. That's what it means for God's power to be made perfect in weakness. God robbed them of their strength so that they had to rely on his strength. When they were weak, then they looked to God, and so then they were strong. That is what God did with Paul. God wanted to use Paul powerfully to spread the gospel, so he made Paul weaker. He sent persecutions and sufferings. He sent opposition from all sides, and he let Satan send the thorn in the flesh to torment him. He was tearing apart all of Paul's self-sufficiency and leaving him at the end of his rope, kneeling broken on the floor in tearful dependence, because when Paul was weakest, that was when Paul was actually strongest. I guarantee you, Satan was delighted that God let him send the thorn in the flesh. He thought that he would destroy Paul's ministry and crush the progress of the gospel, when in reality, by that very action, he was clearing the way for God to be all the stronger in Paul's weaknesses, and so for the gospel to see all the greater success than it ever had. Satan made Paul weak, not knowing that those very weaknesses would be his greatest strength. God does not work through the army of 10,000, but the army of 300. God does not work through the strong. He works through the broken and the weak, because those are the people who know they need him. This has been a huge theme in the letter of 2 Corinthians. In chapter 4, verse 7, he says, "But we have this treasure in jars of clay, to show that this all-surpassing power is from God and not from us. We are frail jars of clay, and that is exactly why God has chosen to use us, because it shows that the power comes from him." Chapter 1, verse 9, Paul says, "We were under great pressure, far beyond our ability to endure, so that we despaired life itself. Indeed, we felt we had received the sentence of death. But this happened that we might not rely on ourselves, but on God, who raises the dead." God pushed them to their limit and then beyond, overwhelming them with more than they could bear, so that they had to rely on him. There's a lot of passages in 1 Corinthians as well, but I'll just highlight chapter 1, verse 26. "Brothers and sisters, think of what you were when you were called. Not many of you were wise by human standards. Not many were influential. Not many were of noble birth. But God chose the foolish things of the world to shame the wise. God chose the weak things of the world to shame the strong. God chose the lowly things of this world and the despised things and the things that are not to nullify the things that are, so that no one may boast before him." God specifically chose to work through the weakest people because they were the people who knew they needed him. God never works through those who are self-sufficient. He works through those who are dependent. And that is why God made Paul weak. Paul was surrounded by sufferings and weaknesses and the thorn in the flesh, constantly being reminded how weak he was. And Paul was grateful for that reminder. 2 Corinthians 12:10. "That is why, for Christ's sake, I delight in weaknesses, in insults, in hardships, in persecutions, in difficulties. For when I am weak, then I am strong." He delights in how weak God has made him, because he knows it keeps him humble and dependent on God. And that's why he says in verse 9, "Therefore I will boast all the more gladly about my weaknesses, so that Christ's power may rest on me." Whereas Paul was completely indifferent about his strengths, they didn't mean much to him, his weaknesses meant the world to him. They were what let him be used by God. He understood that the Christian life was never about our strength. It was always about God's strength. And he understood that it was a zero-sum game. The more of our strength we use, the less of God's strength will be provided. But the less of our strength, the the more of his strength. And so Paul went all in. He threw his strength completely out the window, ignored everything that he could boast about, and instead boasted about how weak he was. Where he didn't give much thought to his strengths, he kept his weaknesses before him at all times. He treasured them. That list of all his sufferings in chapter 11 was just as much for his benefit as it was for the Corinthians. He wanted them to know how weak he was, but even more so, he wanted himself to remember he was weak, because that would keep him dependent. And notice, the sufferings were never pleasant. Even knowing how much spiritual benefit his weaknesses gave him, he still pleaded with God 3 times to remove the thorn in the flesh. But God didn't remove it, because he wanted to use Paul for such great things. If we rely on our own strength, we're done for. We can do nothing apart from God. In our spiritual life, in serving God, in any part of our life, if we are confident and self-sufficient, then we've already lost. But when we are broken before God in humility and dependence, we have already won. We should be grateful to be weak. We should tell other people how weak we are. We should delight in weakness. That's very counterintuitive, but that's what Paul is doing. He is presenting a way of life that is completely opposite the false teachers, who desperately tried to convince everyone how strong they were. Paul desperately tried to convince everyone how weak he was. He wanted to make sure they knew he could do nothing on his own, that it was all because of God working through him. He was setting an example for the Corinthians, and he is urging them to choose the way of weakness rather than the way of strength. We don't need to go listing all of our weaknesses like Paul did, but what is the attitude in our heart? Are we self-confident, or are we dependent? That's what it all comes down to. Paul was grateful for how weak he was because he knows the human heart. He knows we are so prone to get confident. It's so easy not to depend on God. Like Gideon, we all start with the army of 10,000 soldiers. That's why we have to remember that we are weak. And that's why Paul kept his weaknesses front and center. Those weaknesses did hinder his work, but not having those weaknesses would hinder his work even more, because then he wouldn't rely on God. Our weaknesses and failings are never going to be pleasant. Again, they weren't for Paul. Like Paul, we can still plead with God to take them away. Whatever struggles and problems we have, I'm not saying we have to love them and smile through them, but we should always remember that God's grace is sufficient for us. Whatever weaknesses we do have, they are not the end for us. Just like our strengths, they do not affect who we are, but they do make room in our lives for God to work. If you want to be used by God, but you feel weak, not up to the task, not good enough, God is so excited to use you. You are just the person that God wants. If you are here today and you want God to work in your life, but you think you're too much of a mess, your life is in shambles, you could not be in a more perfect place for God to do great things through you. When you are weak, then you are strong. It's very hard to delight in our weaknesses, as Paul did. It's even harder to boast in our weaknesses. But at the very least, let your weaknesses bring you to Jesus. Let them take you to your knees at the foot of the cross and acknowledge that you need him. Whatever you resent most about yourself, whatever you struggle with the most, let that weakness be an open door for God to enter into your life. Humility is so, so beautiful in his eyes. If we let our weaknesses bring us before him in humility, we will see great things done.